from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You don't have to be an employee of United Airlines to be a little airsick about what's going on at the world's number two air carrier right now. The company has halted contribution to its own employees' pension fund, $568 million this year alone. On Monday, the Machinists Union filed a lawsuit in federal court challenging the move. With United trying to slam the brakes on its pension obligations, American workers are left wondering if their companies will follow United down the runway and leave them high and dry in their golden years. Tonight on Point, United Airlines' big duck of its pension promise and the implications for all Americans' retirement plans. We begin tonight with a closer look at the airline industry and United's nosedive. Sean Tully is a senior writer at Fortune magazine and covers the airline industry. Sean, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure, Tom.
Give us some context here. United is in bankruptcy proceedings. What's plaguing this big, very famous, venerable air carrier?
Well, United has been in bankruptcy since December of 2002. The airline costs were and still are much, much higher than the costs of its competitors, specifically Southwest, JetBlue, AirTran, and all of the relative upstart low-cost carriers that are absolutely killing the majors. And United had one of the highest cost structures in the industry. I think everyone remembers the summer of 2000 when the pilots staged slowdowns. They didn't even go on strike, but the slowdowns were enough to force the management to set a very, very bad precedent for the industry with an enormous raise in the already inflated pay of the pilots, which then led to a series of capitulations by other airlines who paid too much. Their costs soared. Then, of course, the whole market went south at that point, and United got caught with very inefficient work rules, very overpaid employees, and an onslaught of very low-cost carriers with much younger workforces, which, of course, is a very relevant issue now, that were able to provide the same service at much lower prices. This is a problem, Tom, that you have with every one of the five incumbent carriers.
Those being
and
United.
I mean the ones that existed before deregulation.
Mm-hmm. And besides employee compensation, Sean, what are the other factors that go into the different cost structure that's so different between Southwest, JetBlue, and the big older guys like United?
Right. Well, naturally, they all are suffering from very high fuel costs. The difference is that the more profitable low-cost airlines, and they're actually making money, believe it or not, mm-hmm. even AirTran and JetBlue and Southwest in this marketplace with these fuel costs, are able to hedge their fuel prices so that they're able to still to buy fuel at lower prices because they've taken out futures contracts at lower prices.
Why can't United do that, let's say?
Well, they're so strapped for cash, they just don't have the resources to do that. So the most of the majors, including United, just made a conscious decision, we're not going to hedge. And therefore, they get stuck paying $44 a gallon for fuel oil, and they their costs therefore, although prices are uniform in the spot market, because they were unable to hedge, were forced to overpay in effect for fuel oil. They also have extremely inefficient work rules. If pilots are switched from one type of airline to another, they have to go through this entire training process, which takes them out of the workforce for months and months and months at a time, so that you have far fewer hours worked per month for the employees of the older airlines, such as United, than you do at a place like Southwest, which has a much younger workforce and much more flexible work rules. You also have a bitter, unhappy workforce that trashes the airline, doesn't respect management, undermines customer service. We see this all the time with public fights. We just saw a machinist union member, or actually a union leader, saying that the airline shouldn't be using the employees as human fertilizer. I mean, that type of publicity is very bad for the brand image. And those things, you also have an older air fleet, which is more expensive to run.
Just plain older airplanes.
Yeah, just older airplanes. So all of those things together bring their cost per passenger mile to about 10.6 cents. We're talking about 6 cents for JetBlue. And that's after United cut $5 billion a year out of its annual cost structure,
wow,
including $2.5 billion in concessions from the workforce. And it still costs with that cost structure. The problem these airlines are having, Tom, is that they believe, and they continue to believe, totally mistakenly, that they can charge a premium and they can have higher costs than the discounters.
Because they're United, they've got the bigger reputation.
Big reputation, great brand name, superior service, superior network. It's not true. It's been proven over and over again. They're simply deluding themselves. They can only succeed if they have costs that are as low or lower than the discounters.
Sean, give us a very simple example. Roughly speaking, how do pay salaries for United pilots versus, I don't know, JetBlue or Southwest, how do they compare?
Well, they compare as follows. Prior to the cuts, and so we're talking about the airlines that have not been in bankruptcy, and
okay,
there's four of them that have not, or not, and two of them are in bankruptcy.
United, U.S. Airways and United are in, is that right?
In bankruptcy. So their pilot salaries have come down, and so have the benefits. But typically, you're talking up to $300,000 a year for a pilot.
That's at United versus?
Versus for a JetBlue, about 80.
Ooh, that's a difference.
So you're we're talking maximum, or 80 to 100 at the maximum scale. Average is probably 220 to 250 at the old carriers versus 80.
Now, into all this comes this retirement question and the pension,
yeah,
obligations, and those must be very large for a big old air carrier like United.
Yeah, they have an old workforce. They have 58,000 retirees. They only have 62,000 employees. Can you imagine that kind of
almost as many retired?
That's worse than our balance in retirees in the general population by an enormous margin. And so they have a very, very high benefit structure. All of this was grandfathered in prior to deregulation, when you just passed costs on to customers endlessly because there was no real price competition in the industry. So it's been trying to dismantle that old structure that's so horribly difficult. Now, United made a very serious error because when they were negotiating with their creditors just after going into bankruptcy in 2002, and into 2003, they did not address the pension question. They decided to cut benefits and cut other benefits and cut salaries, but they left pensions in place as kind of a carrot to the unions. And Glenn Tilton, who comes from the oil industry, from Chevron Texaco, who's the CEO of United, tried to make nice with the unions.
Mm-hmm.
And other CEOs have used that strategy because they don't want to just keep on antagonizing the unions and make customer service worse.
So at this point, they've said that they're temporarily stopping pension payments while they work out their bankruptcy. But the fear is that this will be a permanent jettisoning of those obligations.
Oh, absolutely. I think what they were hoping is when they got turned down on June 29th for that, first it was $1.6, then $1.1 billion loan guarantee from the ATSB for the federal government. They were hoping, I believe, that the federal government would say, well, you got to reform your pensions or you got to stop paying pensions.
No.
Or we're not going to give you the money. And they would have had cover with the unions. You notice that that happened with U.S. Airways. The government came along and said, well, unless you can stop paying these enormous benefits, we're not going to give you the money.
Because you're sunk.
You're sunk, right. And so what U.S. Airways did was they made a mistake, too. They paid off these big lump sums to their pilots, and they exhausted a lot of their cash doing that. But at least they got rid of these enormous ongoing pension obligations. United never addressed the problem. Now that they got rejected, they're forced to address it.
Sean Tully, quickly, look a couple of years out here. What are the prospects for these big, older airlines? Are they all going to go away? What happens if they do?
Well, they can't raise money. United now wants to raise $2 billion, which is what they wanted to get through the loan guarantee. I talked to top executives in this industry, Tom. They feel that two majors out of six will be gone within 5 years. We'll be down to four.
And those four likely to remain? Do they name them?
Well, I would say the two most vulnerable are clearly the two in bankruptcy,
right?
United and U.S. Airways. And the industry has fiercely resisted these bailouts and are actually happy to see these competitors being severely weakened, because they think that if they go out of business, all those flights end and they can raise their prices. They're always hoping they can get prices back up to the glory days of the late 90s.
But I hear a big note of skepticism in your voice, Sean.
Right, and they never will. It's over. Because in those days, business travelers in the bubble period would pay anything. Companies were flush with profits. They weren't nearly as vigilant on travel costs. And there wasn't as much low-fare competition. They are hoping those days come back via the exit of United and or U.S. Airways. They are not coming back. What's going to happen, Tom, is that those routes are going to be snapped up over time by the most efficient players, who are not these airlines.
Sean, we've got it. It's a bloody battlefield, but that's the battlefield in front of us in the airline industry. Thanks a lot for the analysis.
Thank you, Tom.
Sean Tully covers the airline industry for Fortune magazine. He spoke with me from New York. We are talking tonight about the United saga and about U.S. corporations and their wavering commitment to fulfill their pension promises. Did you spend a career flying the friendly skies of United? Is the company dumping you now in retirement when it's in trouble? When things get tough, are pension obligations becoming excess baggage to be tossed overboard? Do strapped corporations have a choice? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from South Bend, Indiana, is Teresa Gilarducci, professor of economics and director of the Higgins Labor Research Center at the University of Notre Dame. She's a member of the General Accounting Office Policy Advisory Panel. Her forthcoming book is The Attack on Retirement. Good evening and welcome, Teresa Gilarducci.
Oh, hi.
Thanks for being with us.
Sure.
Also with us from Charlottesville, Virginia tonight is Richard Brownlee, professor at the Darden Graduate School of Business Administration at the University of Virginia and an authority on corporate pension plans and corporate financial reporting. Richard Brownlee, thanks to you for being with us tonight.
Greetings from Seaville.
Good to have you. One note, I should say, we invited United Airlines to participate on this program. They did not respond to our request. Richard Brownlee, to you first, if I may. What's going on here? Is this within the realm of expectation of how American corporations in duress act these days, or are some boundaries being crossed here?
A little bit of both, I think. Clearly, I think it's fair to say that when pension plans first began, and we go back now really in the U.S. Probably into the 30s, with the expectation that this would be something that would attract and retain employees, and they continued to grow, and for a host of reasons through the years got bigger and bigger. What we're seeing now is a dose of reality, and part of what brought that on was a lot of benefits being granted for a host of reasons, which we can talk a little bit about later. And part of it just comes from enormous competition. Sean's summary was right on point in what he had to say. And the days of price increases are gone, and those organizations that think they're going to come back are wrong. And it's bloody. And when things are bloody, you look and see how you have to dance. And one of the places you can dance is where the money is.
Teresa Gilarducci, let me turn to you for a moment before the break here. What do you see going on here? Corporate irresponsibility in their, husbanding of pension resources and planning, or just a changed economic battlefield and corporations doing the necessary?
Yeah, I disagree with Professor Brownlee a bit. He proposes that the chickens are coming home to roost, that corporations will have to get real, and that, situation has changed so that workers just have to accept declining job quality, declining pensions, broken promises.
That's what it feels like very often these
well,
days.
Well, that just presupposes that, corporations face unforeseen circumstances. Instead, I see an environment where corporations, because of a host of lots of issues that all businesses face, really attack the weakest link. And in this environment, the weakest links are promises made to workers. And it's not quite right, and it doesn't have to happen.
We're going to have to come back and dig into all of that. Teresa Gilarducci, please stand by in South Bend, Indiana, and Richard Brownlee in Charlottesville, Virginia. Listeners, you can join us tonight. We're talking about United Airlines' big duck of its pension obligations and the implications of that for all Americans' retirement plans. Are corporations today too quick to walk away from pension obligations when things get tough? Do they have a choice? Aren't pension promises almost a sacred trust? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about United Airlines' big duck of its pension obligations and the implications of that for all Americans' retirement plans. You can join our conversation tonight. What do you think? Aren't pension promises almost a kind of sacred trust between employer and employee? Or are rock-solid pension guarantees now a thing of the past, a relic of a passing American century? Have pension promises been made to you? Are you confident, as we talk tonight, that those promises will be kept? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Teresa Ghilarducci, professor of economics at the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana, and Richard Brownlee, professor at the Darden Graduate School of Business Administration at UVA in Charlottesville, Virginia. You can join the conversation as well. Teresa Ghilarducci, let me go to you first. Now, when this happens, a big company stops paying its pension obligations. There is a federal fail-safe here, the Federal Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. United retirees will continue to receive, depending on their pension benefit, all or a portion of what they were promised. Isn't that true?
That's absolutely right. The Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation ensures the pension benefits of corporations that have these kind of plans, these type of plans, the defined benefit plans.
So what's the problem?
There really isn't much. There was in 1974 when it was passed an anticipation that some of the older industries that just thrived after World War II and needed all these workers to commit themselves to those industries would have, as Mr. As your first guest noted,
Richard Brownlee,
really, the one from Fortune magazine.
Sean Tully, yeah.
Yeah, that these companies are mini welfare states. You know, they have mini social security systems that they have retirees that a smaller workforce has to support. We anticipated that would happen in steel and to some extent autos. It hasn't happened there yet, and in airlines. So we have an insurance company that will pay the benefits of most of the non-pilot, you know, the not so highly paid employees.
And this is the federal system, the so-called Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. But they only pay up to a certain point. I'm reading about pilots here whose retirement income could be more than halved because the federal system only pays up to, what, $40,000 a year?
About $44,000 changes every year. And not all pilots. You know, many pilots will get their full benefits. So, yes, there is this unfortunate group of highly paid employees that won't get their full amount. Much of the reason why they won't get that full amount is because these companies let the pilots that have already retired take their money out in a lump sum, not in a steady stream of income.
Mm-hmm.
So really they almost invited this disaster, the companies did.
Richard Brownlee, the federal system, we understand, has something like $35 billion in reserve. All companies that pay pensions, I guess, pay into this. But we're also reading it has a $9 billion deficit that it's running now. Is there the possibility of more corporations walking away from their pension obligations, of the federal insurance program for pensions being having a kind of run on the bank, being overrun, running out of cash?
Well, I think that's one of the concerns. That's why this issue is attracting so much attention. And let me say that my answer before about what we're seeing, why we're seeing what we're seeing, wasn't to suggest that I'm feeling good about what these companies are doing. Mm-hmm. I'm not. I think your comment earlier that this was really a sacred trust that the employees had with their employers was, in fact, right. Now we're seeing that being broken, and it's really unfortunate. So I'm not feeling good about what's going on, but the reality of the marketplace, based on a number of decisions that were made and some things that are going on in certain industries,
yep.
That's what's causing companies to have to take a look at this. And it's unfortunate. And it could go beyond this. Certainly the airline industry, there are others in the airline industry that are looking at this. And if United walks away from this huge obligation, others are likely to follow. And that's a scary situation.
What about the auto industry? Teresa Ghilarducci mentioned it.
We have learned some lessons from what steel, but mainly airlines, had done. We had regulation and rules established that really that let Bethlehem, Polaroid, United stop making pension contributions to their pension funds that weren't, on the face of it, well-funded. But the accounting rules let them appear to be well-funded. So these airlines, these profit and steel companies, took pension holidays, funding holidays. We have to make sure that doesn't happen in telecommunications and in the auto industry. So there is something that government can do now to prevent this kind of catastrophe.
Well, is this another, let me ask you, Teresa, is this another kind of corporate scandal? I mean, as you say, they were supposed to be funded. Accounting rules didn't hold them to that. They didn't fund them. But isn't it, I mean, they were some of them were presumably issuing dividends during those years. People were making money off the profits. The stocks were doing whatever they did. What about the workers' obligation, commitment here?
You know, I've come to the conclusion that it's absolutely a scandal on the order of Enron selling its stock to workers in their 401ks when they knew that it was worth nothing. In 2001, when the stock market was crashing, and many of us and companies were earning negative double-digit returns in the stock market, a number of companies, Northwest Airlines, Wirehouse, Federal Express, Eli Lilly, assumed that their pension funds were going to earn 10-12% positive returns for the next 10 years.
Meaning they didn't have to put cash in because they were making these high return assumptions that the market would take care of it.
Some had to put zero cash, some put a lot less. They can just make up reality. And that's even worse than, you know, so Halliburton making up what their earnings were or WorldCom. So there has been this institutionalized and almost as, you know, it's given permission, it's legitimated among the world of consultants and actuaries that companies can really have an accounting fiction in their accounts. Workers were not protected as they should have been.
Richard Brownlee, what about it? Is that a kind of scandal as CEOs go home with record high compensation? Corporations, pretty much knowingly, as Teresa Ghilarducci describes it, underfunding their pension plans for years to come.
Well, it gets us right into the world of accounting and financial reporting, no question. I have to say, though, that the pension area and the number of assumptions and judgments and estimates in pension accounting are enormous. And one can have legitimate differences of opinion. Now, when you see the high returns continuing to be assumed by companies when the market crashed, their argument, this is a long-term phenomenon, and therefore we're going to continue to have optimistic projections. I'm sure some of them really pushed the envelope. But it's important to recognize the complexity and the difficulties of the pension accounting area. And the fact when we didn't really have much of a way of pension accounting back before the mid-80s, that's when we saw an awful lot of the companies granting huge pension benefits because the accounting scorecard didn't show any current expense. We've improved a lot since then. We're still not where we need to be. And we may open this up in the near future, but I don't think the FASB here in the U.S. nor companies want to do that just because it'll be another stock option fiasco probably where all the politicians get involved. But there's lots involved here. Some abuses have taken place. But pension accounting is very, very complicated, and that's one of the issues that we're wrestling with.
Teresa Ghilarducci, at the same time, that kind of complexity can lead to trouble. We see people we read people comparing the potential problem here to a kind of savings and loan S&L debacle in the pension realm. Do you see that?
No, I don't actually see that. I'm not going to be that hyperbolic.
Good.
I want to be a little just go back to first principles. Companies got a lot out of being able to provide pensions without having to pay taxes on the earnings and the contributions. We as taxpayers, people who don't even work for these companies, pay for these pensions because taxes aren't collected on that compensation,
mm-hmm.
as if they would if they were just paid in wages.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a public policy benefit seen from that. Taxpayers would accept that because we would have corporations with loyal, skilled workforces. I mean,
mm-hmm.
there was a deal there. And in my view, the corporations have been allowed to really not meet their end of the bargain.
So they got the tax break but didn't deliver what they promised.
And just imagine what it does to a 50 and a 55-year-old who their whole life has not only worked in order to get that pensions, but actually had a psychological stance about how they had a commitment from an employer whose management they saw every day.
Sure, that was essential building block of their understanding of their working life and retirement.
In my research in the book that I'm doing, not having your pension almost assaults people's identity and a sense of trust about the world around them. It causes a great deal of depression. And at the end of people's lives, for something that they played by the rules and have that broken, is a very difficult psychological situation as well as financial situation.
Of course, it's an interesting situation now where an awful lot of Americans don't even have pensions anymore, so can't necessarily relate. And yet, a lot of promises have been made. I want to turn to our callers. We're looking tonight at United Airlines walking away from pension obligations and asking how wide this may go. This may spread. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Tim is calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a couple comments if I could.
Yeah.
First one on the pilot pay issue and the second one on the pension issue. I'm a regional pilot. And I'm just kind of getting my start in the career, and I get kind of frustrated once in a while when I hear about, talking about the United pilots making $300,000 plus and the JetBlue guys, making $80,000. Those numbers are accurate, but what they don't compare is the fact that that United guy took 20-plus years to get there to make that money, and JetBlue is a relatively young company, and over the course of the time as they grow, their labor is going to increase as well.
So you'd like to be able to aspire to that kind of income and that kind of pension. Do you see your own financial horizons shrinking in this conversation, Tim?
I don't. With the first, going to the kind of the pension end of it, I know if my company that I'm working for now, if they said, I'm going to have this great pension that I can retire on in 30 or 40 years, I wouldn't be contributing nearly as much to my 401k. I think it's unfair that these guys are told they're going to have these great pensions and they live their lifestyle based on that. And then all of a sudden they come to their end of their 20 years. And you have to consider that when you start out, like at my point in my career, you start out only making $20,000 for the first, 10 years of your career. And then all of a sudden you get to this point where you think you have this great pension and they're not contributing to their 401k perhaps. And all of a sudden, it's all gone. And these guys, you can't fly after you're 60, so what are they going to do?
Right. That's exactly the issue. You put your finger right on it. Tim, thanks for calling. Richard Brownlee, is there fine print in here somewhere that says, yes, we promise you this pension, but no, we don't have to deliver it?
The spirit certainly wasn't there. There has been a commitment that's been broken. I think Teresa was right when she talked about the devastation financially, and psychologically to folks. No one ever intended that the fine print would say when times get tough, all bets are off. That's just not the way it was supposed to be.
Let's turn to another call. Jack is calling from Eagle River, Wisconsin. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a retired labor lawyer. I used to represent management for over 30 years. Since retirement, I've had a chance to have, as the Greeks call it, metanoia, a change of heart.
Yeah.
What I've seen, in my opinion, I agree with Professor Ghilarducci, which is our whole system, since its inception, is based on favoring organized capital over certainly organized labor and definitely over unorganized labor. The whole bankruptcy code is geared to protecting creditors, financial creditors, not workers. Just look at the preferences that are given, et cetera. Wages aren't treated anywhere near like the way other types of debts are for corporations. And with regard to pensions and wages, we've seen, and I saw it myself, in the 1980s, the meatpacking industry, due to overcapacity, wages were used as a way to drive down prices. Because all your fixed assets, like for airlines, are constant. You can't bargain about anything or change the prices, except wages. And so they're used as a tool to drive down the power of unions and non-union workers alike. We saw it in trucking. And I view it, again, with a major change of heart since my own retirement and regret for what I did in my relative youth.
We're hearing it right now.
Which is our system favors organized capital.
But, Jack, let me ask you something. Richard Brownlee brings up, and it's hard to deny, the markets have changed, and United is in a difficult spot right now. So what do they do? Where's the error here? Where's the fault lie? They've got to compete. They can't compete. They need to strip down. They look and say, well, the pension's one of the few things we can dump here.
Well, my belief is, sure, they can use that as an excuse, but our whole system, the government and the airlines, love it. And the people who control the capital in this country love it. Why? Because they will drive out the union competition that pays the higher wage rates and be left with the devil take the hindmost and the cheapest labor, just as we're sending labor and jobs overseas. And again, I regret what I did with regard to that, too, seeing companies go overseas where there's cheap labor. We in America thrive on two things, in my opinion, cheap labor and cheap raw material. We have since our beginning, and I don't see an end to that. I don't see government policies doing anything to change that. And as long as we have that, and we will, in my opinion, for the foreseeable future, it's everybody get ready for the party's over. It's devil take the hindmost, and we're going to go down to the lowest common denominator.
Well, there's the heartfelt mea culpa from the retired labor lawyer. Jack, thanks very much for calling. Teresa Ghilarducci, what about it? Is this... There's a lot of talk about American living standards heading down. Is this a camouflaged way of cutting off chunks of Americans' standard of living?
Yes, in a word. We told the story, and it's great the program started with a narrative about, you know, a particular company, is that the strategy, and United Management and to some extent United Shareholders are going along with this strategy, use this situation, 9/11, high fuel prices, to just change the structure and promises of labor relations in the industry, so that United can use the excuse of these small, you know, startups with very young men and women, you know, driving the airplanes, as an excuse to say, okay, you thought airline work was middle class work, you're wrong.
But what about the market? What about the lower cost competition? That's a fact, isn't it?
The market is used as an excuse. Markets are regulated, and markets are regulated according to what we you know, feel is a priority. Without regulation, we could have children serving our drinks, you know, on the airlines. So the market can't be used as an excuse. Markets are regulated. In Europe, you don't have people flying airplanes, even though they have the same fuel prices, that are paying, you know, that are less than middle class jobs.
But they don't. They also don't have the cheap airfares we have. So is this a roundabout way of benefiting the American mass, but taking it out of the mouths of United retirees?
Well, since the consumers are also workers, you know, we think we might be winning because we get cheap prices, but in fact we're losing because our wages are falling along with us. But you got your fingers right on the point that shareholders and consumers have to pay a little bit. They can't get away with just cutting labor. I mean, those chickens will come home to roost when we have just a declining standard of living for everybody.
Well, we start pulling this string and a lot of things tumbling out on the tabletop here. Teresa Ghilarducci, Richard Brownlee, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about United Airlines' big duck of its pension obligations and the implications of that for all Americans' retirement plans. Have pension promises been made to you? Are you confident they will be kept? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about American corporations and their apparently shrinking commitment to making good on pension promises, particularly about United Airlines, saying it has stopped payment on its pension obligations. Looking at the implications of that for all Americans' retirement plans, you can join our conversation. Did you spend a career flying the friendly skies of United? Is United dumping you now in retirement? Have pension promises been made to you? Are you confident they'll be kept? And I guess a question for our younger listeners, is this all Greek to you? Is pension talk the stuff of ancient history? Are you confident your 401k will fare better? We're at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Teresa Ghilarducci at Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana. And Richard Brownlee joins us from the Darden Business School at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia. Right now, Buddy is calling from Truro, Massachusetts. Hi, Buddy. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
My comments are that they really come from a very large body of experience. Before I retired, I was a member in the 60s and the 70s of the small law firm that probably had the largest labor practice in the country.
Okay, so you've been inside the negotiations there.
We represented five international unions at various times, as well as constituent bodies, and a constitutional department of the AFL-CIO itself.
And you watched them negotiate wages and pensions, I assume?
I've seen too much of what happened there, and, you know, the corporation bashing is fascinating when nobody turns around and looks at the unions.
Well, turn us around. Let's look at it. What do you see?
Well, the first thing is all of those assumptions, actuarial assumptions that people were talking about, which made the plans have huge unfunded liabilities, they're correctly described, but they fail to point out that each one of those assumptions is subject to collective bargaining.
You mean the union said, yes, we also think you'll get 10 to 20% return
and
on that.
In fact, and oftentimes the union would suggest to the employer that they change the actuarial assumptions to reduce the monies going in so that there will be a larger pool available to pay current workers wages.
So they were sort of part of a charade, you're saying here.
Well, it's a political process.
Oh, but
John Maynard Keynes, when he wrote his general theory, Money, Interest, and Employment, talked about the long run and said the long run will all be dead. Every one of these people figured when the problems arise, they'd be retired, like I am.
But, Buddy, stick with us for a second. I hear Professor Ghilarducci there. Teresa Ghilarducci, yeah. What do you say?
No, I did my research on this about 20 years ago, interviewing negotiators in all sorts of industries. There was only one union, the UAW, that had an actuary on staff. And I agree with Buddy that there was a real sophisticated understanding among the union bargainers that if you would raise, if you would change the assumptions, you would get more money on the table.
So were they selling their own union members' retirements down the river?
But in no way was that kind of temptation equal to what corporations have done systematically over the past 30 years. It may have happened in his experience, but it was no way widespread for lots of reasons. Mainly, corporations have total control over the way that money is managed, effectively and even legally. So I just reject that notion. But he does have a point that there was a political bargaining between the employer and the union,
mm-hmm.
but that was predicated on the fact that the company and the union would exist always together in partnership.
There's kind of a two to tango here.
Right.
The
assumptions were made based on a long-term commitment. What has happened is the corporation says, enough, we can live without middle-class represented workers.
Buddy, thanks for your experience and for your call. Let's turn to some more callers. Bob is on the line. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi. My point is you keep referring to this as a trust. To me, it's not a trust. It's a contract. The employer distributes plan documents to the employees in great legal detail.
Yep.
And these represent an inducement to accept employment.
Yes.
So my opinion is that the employer should not be permitted to drop these contracts selectively, only in bankruptcy, and then in bankruptcy courts should be available to adjudicate among creditors, which should include the pensioners.
But they're in bankruptcy now. They're up against the wall. They're in big trouble.
United is, and I'm not talking about that.
I see.
The general position mm-hmm. of companies that are dropping pension plans, if they're dropping them in advance of bankruptcy, I think they should be forced into bankruptcy before they're allowed to do that.
Let us pick it up. Thanks for your call, Bob. Richard Brownlee, how about it? Do you see a kind of full weight of the law, contractual obligation being honored in the observance of pension obligations or not?
I think he was right. I mean, this is a contractual agreement, and what we're looking at now is ways that companies are looking to break that contract. So it's, from the employee standpoint, it's a contract, but I think the employees really feel the trust thing that was it was supported by a contract, but it was a trust. It was a bond between the employees and the organizations, something that we're really not seeing now. There's been a real shift. I see it in my graduate students in the last 5 years. when they look and think about who they're going to go to work for and talk about pensions, the notion that they're going to work for a company a long time, the company is going to be there for them, and they want a defined benefit plan, that's not what's going on with them anymore. They're looking for portability, and they're looking for look out for themselves, and they're interested in the defined contribution plans, not these defined benefit plans.
That is essentially 401k.
It's all changed. Yeah, it's all changed.
So that sort of promised pension, the defined benefit, as you call
it,
going away.
They don't buy it. My students don't buy it anymore.
Let's get one more call here.
They're probably right.
Alex is on the line. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to go back to the United case specifically, you know, how you started out the program.
Yes.
And it sounds from the language you use to address the United move, you call it a duck and a broken promise, that we've sort of prejudged this as a cynical or profit-seeking move by management or organized capital. I mean, the reality is United is always one step away from closing its doors and you know, essentially laying off or firing tens of thousands of workers. How do we balance, you know, what to me sounds like a temporary, you know, put off of payment, you know, out of cash flows it just doesn't have, with the need to keep this company alive as a going concern and pay its employees, repay its creditors
yeah.
in bankruptcy, and ultimately, you know, be able to be in a point where it could pay pensions in the future.
I guess that is, at least from one perspective, exactly the question. And we're trying to do both things here, acknowledge that they're in big trouble, and we spelled that out at the top. But also, there is a ducking going on. I mean, the pension obligations, those payments have been stopped. Teresa Ghilarducci, how do you balance these? They need to stay alive. They need to stay in business to go on paying pensions and employing all those thousands of employees.
That was such a good statement.
No kidding.
And I'm just surprised that they didn't get the loan guarantee from the government. That government loan program was set up just because we all, you know, all the citizens of the United States have some stake in United, you know, ongoing. In some ways, I view it as maybe a bargaining chip by the government, so that United can go back to its workers who have already taken huge concessions. I wish the government would force management to be better, you know, to actually demand some sacrifices from their shareholders as well. I think it's what happening is bargaining is going on now, but I think workers are paying too much of a price. Also, bankruptcy court is supposed to reorganize companies who may be, as the caller just put it, in temporary trouble. So with hope, I mean, there is some hope here. That process, the bargaining with the loan program and the bankruptcy judge, and a little more fairness about who pays the adjustment costs, United will continue. Even though the Fortune magazine analyst thought that United and USA would probably merge, and that might be right.
Merge or go?
No, that's hard to imagine. People still are flying airplanes, and there really is a difference between the regionals and these bigger aircraft.
But the bottom line is, do you believe that a company like United can do both? Can it continue to compete, reorganize, get back out there, make a profit, and continue employing new employees and honor those old pension obligations? Has it cheated against those deliberately or not in such a way that I thought I heard you saying earlier they sort of tilted the table even before they got in trouble?
You know what? They can do it, but these regional airlines can't be driving, racing, pulling United and the other companies down to the bottom. I presume, remember the caller who is a pilot in those regional airlines?
Yes.
He didn't like his pay rate. He thought he was being paid too little.
He wants some headroom. He wants some room to advance.
He wants some advance. And I think these workers will actually unionize. So we consumers will have to pay more for an airplane than we do for a bus. And these workers have to make middle class wages in a career that makes sense. All of us want well-paid, happy pilots.
With that, we're out of time. Everybody wants to retire someday, too. Thanks for all the light you've shown on it tonight. Teresa Ghilarducci at Notre Dame, thanks for being with us in South Bend, Indiana. And Richard Brownlee at the Darden Graduate School of Business, UVA, in Charlottesville, Virginia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, the mother of a new college student wishes she could relive her own freshman year. This is On Point. In just a few weeks, 18-year-olds all over the country will be shipping off to college for the first time. Many of them have recently gotten their first taste of college life at freshman orientation, which many schools now hold in the middle of summer. Maryland resident Susan Reimer recently took her daughter, Jessie, to freshman orientation at Penn State, but Jessie did not seem impressed. In this radio diary, Susan Reimer ponders her daughter's utter ambivalence toward her upcoming college adventure.
My fellow mothers and I have recently returned from taking our freshmen to their prospective colleges for orientation, otherwise known as the reality check, and we are not reassured. Never have we seen a group of children so blasé about being supported in the style to which they have become accustomed while living beyond our reach. College is exactly that, a kind of fully funded semi-adulthood with all of the freedoms and none of the responsibilities. But for some reason, our children do not appear to be excited about the prospect of not having to obey us for free. Perhaps it is because after 12 years spent trapped in school buildings, they are burned out on the process. My daughter Jessie said at one point on our tour, "God, I am just so tired of this whole education thing." And they appear to be burned out, too, on the sports that they once burned to play in college. As one child said, "It's about not being good enough all over again." Even the shopping required for college, a massive infusion of clothes and dorm room accessories, doesn't seem to trigger much enthusiasm. The reason might be that, for most of these children, college is not a privilege or even a choice. It is a decision someone else made 18 years ago when they bought that first savings bond for the purpose of paying for it. It is the rare, brave individualist who can step off this conveyor belt for a year and work or travel or volunteer or just grow up. These feelings of ambivalence have not infected the parents, however. These orientation sessions are trips down memory lane for parents, most of whom went to college and, with the help of selective memory, now consider it to have been the best 4 years of their lives. Our goofy enthusiasm contrasts sharply with the bored looks on the faces of our children, and our amusing anecdotes about college pranks and adventures and the deprivations of student poverty seem to require translation if they are to be understood. One thing is clear, we wish it was us. Almost universally, my fellow parents and I would love to do college all over again. And the appeal goes beyond the freedom to read and study things about which we are now curious. We like everything about college. We like the idea of trading a van or a station wagon, cluttered with family junk and waiting to drop its transmission, for a backpack and a bicycle. We like the idea of keeping house in only half a dorm room instead of three full floors. We love the idea that a staff cleans the bathrooms. We like the idea of eating in a cafeteria instead of running a cafeteria. We don't care about the reputation of the food. Everything tastes good if you don't have to cook it. We love the idea of an 8 a.m. class. It sure beats waiting up for somebody with a 1 a.m. curfew. We don't even mind coin-operated washers and dryers, because the only laundry we will be doing will be ours, and it will actually be dirty instead of simply cast aside. We like the idea that we will be required to read books, no more feeling guilty about time not spent on chores. And we would be so grateful that any homework will be ours, and if we don't do it, we will have only ourselves to blame for the consequences. Not only would we enjoy all the ways the life of a single college student would differ from the life of the head of a household, we would appreciate it this time around. We would drink in every drop of knowledge, and not a few beers, and we would sleep late on weekends. No doubt about it. If youth is wasted on the young, then college certainly is too.
Susan Reimer is a columnist with the Baltimore Sun. She lives in Annapolis, Maryland, with her husband and two children. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.